Well, good morning. My name is Tarek. I'm an addict and alcoholic. Last night we referenced this prayer that we work with. It's called the lay aside prayer or the set aside prayer. The big book references the idea of laying aside old ideas, the concept of laying aside old ideas. And if this is not your first trip to a place like the Bridges or treatment center or going into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous, and then, you know, your mind tells you you did part of the process, and sometimes it tells you you did the whole process when in actuality you did maybe six steps and you went to a bunch of meetings and hung out with some people and nothing transformed about your character or your thinking process, and therefore when the trials of low spots of life hit, you found yourself high or drunk. Because we must have an anesthetic to deal with the world, and it comes in the form of drugs and alcohol for many years. And so we have all these ideas that we bring to the table, and the mind tells us that we know what it's going to look like. And that's the great challenge that we have, is to bring a baby mind, a newborn mind, to this process, which puts us in a place of excitement and anticipation, which is a good place to be. And we have found with our personal, in our personal experiences using this prayer, that it will do that. It'll sometimes create a bewilderment or discomfort or a feeling that you don't know, which is also good. Because a great man named Thomas Merton once said that those who say they know from the very beginning will come to know nothing at all. And so this morning, we're going to take a minute and take a couple of deep breaths. I've got the prayer up here. Can everybody see it, or are we in the way?
Good.
And then I'll indicate, and we're all going to say the prayer, and we'll get the day started. Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all of these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
I'd like to read something out of 365 Dow. It's called Healing. Fire cools, water seeks its own level. No matter how extreme a situation is, it will change. It cannot continue forever. Thus, a great forest fire is always destined to burn itself out. A turbulent sea will become calmer. Natural events balance themselves out by seeking their opposites. And this process of balance is at the heart of all healing. This process takes time. If an event is not great, the balancing required is slight. If it is momentous, then it may take days, years, even lifetimes for things to return to an even keel. Actually, without these slight imbalances, there could be no movement in life. It is being off balance that keeps life changing. Totally centering, total balance would only be stasis. All life is continual destruction and healing, over and over again. That is why, even in the midst of an extreme situation, the wise are patient. Whether the situation is illness, calamity, or their own anger, they know that healing will follow up people. You have recently had some upheaval in your life because you find yourself in a place like the Bridges. There's been destruction in your life. Those of you who engage this process will go through a rebirth. And if you think about it, the actual act of birth for many species, I'm willing to bet, is quite painful and traumatic. That's the first trauma we experience is coming out of that birth canal. And we've been all nice and tucked away, and it's been somewhat dark and calm, and all of a sudden we burst out and we are in this. And that's why the infant's eyes appear to see a new land, a new world. And it's traumatic. There are studies out there that are actually studying that as the first trauma that we experience. And so I like to refer to my sobriety day as my rebirth date. I was reborn on November 5th, 2007. And that rebirth was very traumatic. It was very painful, and it was uncomfortable. But it was mandatory. It was required for me to begin the healing process. Now, what's different for each one of us sitting in this room is the amount of upheaval and destruction it's going to take to catapult you into the healing process. And what happens, the healing begins once, first and foremost, the liar must be dormant. The liar's voice must go away temporarily. That's the only way the healing will begin. As long as the liar's voice is there, he's going to convince you that you're not down the two alternatives. That it's not live life on a spiritual basis or die the alcoholic death. That you've got some things that you can do to make this happen. And I felt moved to read this because there's a part of us, when I was in a place like this the first time, I thought I was going from the light into the dark. And what I found was I was actually moving from the dark into the light. But the way the addict mind tries to trick you is by telling you you guys are entering into a dark, boring, glum area in your life, and you're never going to have fun again, and you're going to have to go to these meetings, and life is no longer going to be what you think it is. That is true. Life is no longer going to mean what you think it means. It will take on new meaning, and you will have a sense of purpose, and you will feel a part of, and you will have the ability to think straight and have some proportion in your life. But it's going to require that you're able to see that you're in a temporary condition if you're willing to make a commitment. If you're not willing to make a commitment and you fit the description of the addict or alcoholic in the big book, then you will continue to suffer and you will die slow, miserable, alcoholic, addict death. And I'm not here to scare you. That's not to scare you. That's just the reality of it. If you fit this description, what are you willing to do to recover? Another important question. What am I willing to do to recover? And it should be answered after you look at the 12 steps with a sponsor, and the sponsor says, this is what it's going to look like for you and I to work these 12 steps together. Go think about it. And then ask me if you're willing to go through with the program of action. All right, we're going to go to page 17 in our big book. Sir.
Does anyone need lights for this part? Right in reading. Is that okay if I hit this side?
Oh, yeah.
I hope you guys can go
We of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered, and they have solved the drink or the drug problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a unity, a friendliness, an understanding, an identification, which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after a rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common problem or peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself cannot hold us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution in this big book. We have a way out, which the first 100 absolutely agreed upon, which tells us we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism and addiction. The reality is, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, there is no longer brotherly and harmonious action about one solid message that everyone carries. It's just not there. You got people that are going to tell you to stick with the winners, 90 meetings in 90 days, stick with the winners, do a bunch of service work, and you'll be fine. You've got other people that are going to say, okay, we're going to work one step a month, and then after a year, you'll be ready to sponsor people. And then you've got people that are going to tell you that you don't need to work the steps. It's all about going to meetings. And then you will have people that tell you, hey, only work the steps 1 through 9 one time. Don't make any amends with your ex-girlfriends. You don't have to pay all that money back. And then we're going to do a little bit with 10, 11, and 12, and we're just going to go to a lot of meetings. You don't ever have to rework the first 9 steps. And then you've got a school of thought that says, I rework the first 9 steps on a regular basis. The reality is those are the different donkeys within the fellowships. And I have been guilty of poking fun at other people's donkeys, but I'm riding a donkey. Right? I just have an attachment to the way I think things should be done. Now, I do believe, and you're not going to convince me otherwise, that the way I see things is it creates an effective spiritual experience. A wonderful structure can be built with a foundation based on the 12 steps. That's what I do because I like the effect produced by what I do. I have greater levels of awareness. I experience more conscious awareness of the presence of God. I get to interact better with God's kids. I mean, that's what it's about. So that's why I continue to look at the work the way I do. But I fell victim to the idea that the fellowship by itself was enough. Going to meetings was enough. And here's what I believe about meetings, and I heard a man say it, and I committed it to memory because I believe it, but the meeting-based sobriety is like in the fellowship, complete dependence on the fellowship, it's like a warm bath. It does not last for long. It works until it doesn't work. And that's why they tell us that it has to be a combination, a magical combination of common problem. That's the first level of healing that takes place. We walk into a meeting and somebody tells part of our story, and for the first time in a long time, I'm like, wow, I'm not the only one that did that. I'm not the only one that destroyed that. I'm not the only one that was done to. And so a level of some healing begins. And then somebody tells my story, but then they tell me how it's been 10 years since they've lived that way. And they have a program of action that keeps them solid, keeps them whole. And that's what we're talking about here. So upon a foundation of complete willingness, so if your first step says you're going to drink again, then if your first step says you're going to use again, and if your first step is rooted in hopelessness, that's a solid foundation. Because now you've been convinced that there's nothing you can do to solve the problem. You've become completely hopeless. We can work with that. And so you pour cement into the foundation. The cement that we pour into this foundation is a magical combination of problem, solution, meetings, and big book. And the book clearly gives us a warning that the fellowship by itself does not work. There's the question, though. Do you believe that just not using and just not drinking and going to meetings is the solution to your problem? You have to answer that question. It's interesting, you know, the first 100 that went through this process, there was 40 of them when they started in 1937. By 1939, there's somewhere between 80 and 100. They say 100, but I've read other books that said it was a little bit less than 100, but, you know, we like to exaggerate everything a little bit. And those first 100 didn't work the steps as outlined in the big book. It was a collective conscious of different individuals' experience working the steps. They were the pioneers. They had these six steps in the Oxford group, and they were working them very fast. And then they decided, you know, there was more of them. There's more of us here today than there were in 1937 when these cats decided that they were going to sit down and write a book because they discovered the answer to the age-long problem of alcoholism. That means that we should be sitting around writing a book right now. We should be comfortable and confident enough to do that. That's what shows me the divinity of this whole process. And the way the universe took that group of people and came up with this. So it was their collective experience, and they agreed. They were in full agreement that this was what they wanted to present to the dying alcoholic who was still suffering. For whatever reason, that's not the case anymore. It's almost like we have a mandatory fellowship with an optional program. In the old days, in the very early days, it was a program that was backed by a fellowship. Everything was based on this, the program. There weren't all these discussion meetings. There were testimony meetings. And there's a part in the back of the book, which people love to talk about, where it says we meet so newcomers can bring their problems. Well, you have to read the history behind this. An Oxford group meeting would typically last anywhere between 3 to 4 hours. They would get to one of the, you know, the house. They would have fellowship. They would bring their families. And then the men would break away into this other room. They would have their meeting. They'd have three speakers. They would all testify about the power of God in their lives. Sometimes they'd take a newcomer up to the upper room when they were in Dr. Bob's neck of the woods in Akron. And then they would have fellowship after the meeting. Yes, you brought your problems, most likely to the part before and after the testimony and what was going on in the upper room. It wasn't that we just puke our problems all over the meetings. That happened to us in the late 60s when addiction and alcoholism now became an illness or a disease. And these insurance companies would come to you when your insurance ran out. And they would say, hey, we can't work with you anymore, but you need to talk about your problems and you need to go to the AA meeting and go talk about your problems. And then we had this influx of thousands and millions of people came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it grew exponentially. It was out of control. It grew so fast and then gave birth to the discussion meeting. And that makes me very sad. It's the best way I can put it. It just makes me very sad. Now the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous is outlined in this big book. It's hard to find. As my buddy Chris calls it, you find these little pockets of enthusiasm, but they're not everywhere. All meetings should be pep rallies for the power of God in our lives, but they're not. That's just not the reality of it. So we have to be spearheads for God's ever-advancing creation. That's our responsibility. All right. Let's turn to the page 18. The ex-problem drinker or drug user who has found this solution, who's properly armed with facts about himself as a result of working the steps, can generally win the entire confidence of another addict or alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding or identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. When you put yourself in a position of sponsorship, you work the steps, you now have a message of depth and weight, you're going to these meetings, you're searching out the newcomer, the most important thing you can do in that initial conversation is qualify and identify. Find out what they have loss of control with. You know, we assume because somebody walks through that door they're automatically alcoholic and addict. That is not true. You have to ask them a question. Why are you here? What are you looking for? What substance do you seem to have a problem with that you can't control the amount you use most of the time or the amount you drink? And when you stop, it seems like you want to stay stopped, but you keep going back. Which substance does that? And so dig a little bit. identify, and then tell your story a little bit. Tell a little bit about loss of control with your drug of no choice. Tell a little bit about your inability to stay away from the first one with your drug or drink. And then convince them that you have a similar experience. You are only going to be able to do that by working the steps yourself and examining your own experience. I say, for a long time, I used to think my drug of choice was crack cocaine. If it was my drug of choice, why didn't I just wake up and choose not to do it? My drug of no choice was crack cocaine. My drugs of choice were the ones that I could make up my mind and put down, and I had a few. I lost power, choice, and control when it came to cocaine and alcohol. That means I had both a physical craving and a mental obsession for both of those things. The next paragraph gives the guidelines for the person looking for the sponsor. So if you guys go home after the bridges and you're still a little bit unclear on what do I need to look for in someone that's going to take me through this process, well, this next paragraph tells you exactly that. It says the man who's making the approach, the sponsor, has had the same difficulty as you. That he obviously knows what he's talking about. That his whole behavior shouts at the new prospect that he is a man or woman with a real answer. That he has no attitude of holier than thou. Nothing except the sincere desire to be helpful. That there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. Ask yourself, was this guy like me? Does he live that way anymore? And does he have an answer that will work for me? These are important questions to ask yourself as you are looking for someone to guide you through the process. The last thing you should answer is, well, can I relate to this guy? That's irrelevant, right? Does he have something about him that just strikes you, that you're attracted to? It could be confidence. It could be his glow. Like, he always seems like he's content. He actually wants what he has. He enjoys his life. He has God in his life. He talks about the big book and the way of life described in the big book. He doesn't want to grind any axes with you. He just wants to be helpful. So, having a transition plan when you guys leave the bridges is key. It's key for you for permanent recovery to get to transition out of here and go somewhere and have a home group. Have a sponsor already lined up. Have a list of 3 to 4 meetings you're going to be regularly going to. You're going to be committed to making relationships, growing relationships with these individuals at a couple of these meetings. If you leave here with no transition plan, I mean specifically home group sponsor, who you're going to be kicking it with, you're in trouble because you've been sheltered here from the real world. And you must have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And that happens through the 12-step process, and then you re-engage society. That's what this is about. It has to be there for you. Otherwise, the liar is going to reemerge himself right there. He will reassert himself on the scene right there. That's all I got.
So, who in here thinks that Tarek and I are completely full of shit? I didn't figure anybody would raise their hand, but there's somebody in here that thinks we're full of shit. But then there's others of you that we've won your confidence because it's apparent from what we're talking about that something's happened in our life. And that's what that paragraph on page 18 talks about. But the first full paragraph on page 19, Tarek and I do not make this our sole vocation, nor do we think we would be effective or we would, if we did. Tarek and I believe that the elimination of our drinking and drugging is but a beginning. That a much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. all of us spend much of our spare time in this sort of effort, which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. I think I mentioned last night that a guy that I sponsor, his he spent basically his entire daughter's life bouncing in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's less than 2 years sober now, and he's finally hooked up with this thing. And he says, he probably says it better than anybody, he said, it wasn't until I realized that sobriety was actually something that I had to commit to, like I commit to a job. I have to give it the same amount of effort. I have to consider working it as much of the time as I do my work. Now, he doesn't spend 40 or 50 hours in meetings, but he's dedicated his life to a way that demonstrates these principles. As a fun exercise, one time I went through and figured out how much time I take out of my day, either driving to a meeting, meeting with a sponsee, in a meeting, cleaning up after a meeting, setting up a meeting. In a regular week, it's somewhere between 18 and 20 hours. My life is full, but I don't go to a meeting every day. I don't think it's necessary, because for me, the fellowship around me that I talk to on the phone and do that covers a lot of that unity. Now, I go to regular meetings, but a much more important demonstration of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that if you came and followed us around, you would see it operate in our lives. You would see it happen to... It was baffling to me that when I would walk into certain meetings when I was new, there would be these... If we were in a meeting with 40 people, there were usually 4, 5, 6 people that seemed to have this thing about them. They were different. There was something... They were weird because they had this energy where they were happy and they were content. And there was something going on within them. And then there was the rest of the people in the meeting that just kind of seemed to just kind of be there. And what I started, because I'm such a judgmental person, is I started really trying to figure out what's up with these couple people that there's something different about. And not only had these people worked the steps, but they had taken this as a way of life and started living it. And it was evident in just their aura. It was evident in how they presented themselves. The last paragraph on page 19. Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance for other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers and drug addicts depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. What do you think they mean by our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs? Do you think that they mean our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs? Because I think if that's not what they meant, that's not what they would have written. They would have written something different. But because that's what they wrote, I think that they mean that my life will not continue to exist if I'm not constantly thinking of others. And I remember when I got here, that seemed so paradoxical, and it seemed like, well, if I'm constantly thinking about others, I'm never going to get anything from me. But the craziest thing is that the more I think about others, the more I do for others, the more I get the stuff that I that I actually need, because the stuff that I used to think I wanted, I no longer want. And that things just show up in my life and it's like, oh, that's wonderful that that's here. But when I was so self-absorbed and self-consumed with myself, I didn't have the ability to even get the things that I needed because I was so busy trying to focus on the things that I wanted. And so this next paragraph is one that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's the group of people that think that they're always going to be sick. They're always going to be recovering. And then there's the people that are recovered and well. Okay? And I love when people challenge this, because the book only says recovered 17 times and only says recovering once, but maybe that's not what they meant. It says, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless, you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, including in the rooms of AA and CA, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic or addict who wants to get well, to get over it, you may already be asking yourself, what do I have to do? It's the purpose of this book to answer those questions specifically. So when they ask a question in the book, they always give you the answer almost immediately. Is that you want to recover from this thing, you want to reach a recovered state, it's in the book. See, again, if you look at the history of things, they had that one meeting a week in Akron on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. One meeting. So what happens when I have to go out of town for business? What do I do? Well, in today's society, if there was one meeting a week in Akron, we're all fucked because we can't go to a meeting. But these guys out of Akron in New York would go, once the book was published, they would take the book with them and they would go find another alcoholic. And then they would establish another little pocket. And then a guy in Texas would write central office and he would say, I want to do what you guys are doing. They'd send him a book. And he would go through the book. And when he went through the book, guess what? He recovered too. So the answer's in the book, but we think the answer's in the meetings. And that's just not how they used to do it when their success rates were so good. If you look at the bottom of this page, page 20, they go in and they start describing the moderate, the hard, and the real alcoholic. Okay, so the moderate may have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. These are the people that are very confused by us because they have two or three and they start... When we were at my buddy's wedding 2 weeks ago, my wife had her... She had a Bloody Mary and then... And then she got a second Bloody Mary at the reception right before we went up for dinner. And she was clearly feeling the second one because she was kind of talking dirty to me. And she's like, now I remember why people drink. She's like, you're a pretty good looking guy, but you're really good looking when I've had a couple drinks. And so she's going to hate that. Well, she's not going to listen to this anyway. So then we go up and we sit down for dinner and she starts drinking water and then she has a coffee and we're there for like 3 more hours and she's done. So she started feeling it and she's like, whoa, breaks. When we start feeling it, what do?
Slam the gas.
Keep going. Party on. So then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change environment, warning of a doctor, having kids, getting married, any of those things, becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. Stop is mental control. Moderate is physical control. Although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. So I don't know if any of you guys have ever done this. When you get sober, you kind of like look back through your history at all your buddies. And you try to figure out who else needs to join you here. Because you're going to go recruit them, right? And like, so there's this, my college buddies, there was this one guy that he was the king of the puke and rally. I mean, this guy could like, we could be somewhere, he would disappear, he'd come back. And you always knew when he puked and he was rallying because he would disappear for a little while and he'd come back and then he'd order shots for everybody in front of him. And he'd keep going. And he'd power through it. And this guy, like, he was usually one of the late night drinkers with me. He was up all night with me. Like, this guy. So I get sober and I'm like, going to go recruit him. I'm going to pull him in. So I call him. And we start talking. And I was asking about, you know, just kind of laying the questions out. How much do you drink? And he's like, dude, I don't have time for that shit. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I might have a couple beers, like, maybe on Friday night. But he's like, we got baseball all Saturday. And then you're at chess club and this and that. And I'm like, see, when you say a couple beers, like, because, I mean, I always told everybody I had two, right? That was, like, the magic number. So, you have two, like, what do you get, like, a case? And he's like, no, I have, like, two. And I'm like, well, do you, like, go switch the mixed drinks after that? And he's like, no, I go to bed. So this was a certain type of hard drinker. This guy was right there with me drinking alcoholically all through college. Gets married, has kids, gets responsibility with the kids. He's done. Now, I'm sure that if we went to the beach and the kids and wife weren't around, he'd probably get a little bit out of control because, you know, that's what idiots like us do. But he'd return to his life and it would be the same again. But then what about the real alcoholic? These are the questions that you have to ask yourself. You may start off as a moderate drinker. You may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of your drinking career, you begin to lose all control of the amount of liquor and drugs you consume once you start to drink or drug. Anybody? Anybody in here? Got any of that going on? Okay. Here's the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking or drugging. Got anybody in here? He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk or high. Anybody? His disposition while drinking or drugging resembles his normal but little. He may be one of the finest fellows, yet let him drink for a day or go on a run, and he frequently becomes disgustingly, even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Anyone? Yeah. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. I only had two. He often possesses special abilities, skills, aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. You know, only alcoholics have a promising career ahead of them. People that are not alcoholic, they actually have a career. We seem to just have promising careers. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then he pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He is a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated, or doesn't go to bed at all, he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early next morning he searches madly for the needle or bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he has it concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high power sedatives and liquor to quiet the nerves so he can go to work. Okay, so these are important paragraphs to read when you're a sponsor, when you're trying to qualify somebody. I had a guy that had come to Alcoholics Anonymous that was certain that he was an alcoholic because he went out and would have 10 or 12 Coors Lights with his buddies every Friday night. And so his wife kicked him out. He made some poor decisions, and he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thinks that he's an alcoholic. And he gets a sponsor who doesn't work the steps but believes in going to the church and doing all these other things and being of service at church. And he's never asked. He's never questioned. He never goes through the exercise that we went through last night of type 1, 2, 3, 4. Nobody's ever taken him to these pages and asked him if any of this is him. So I'm talking to him one night, and I said, "Are you even an alcoholic?" And he goes, "I can't believe you would even ask me that." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, isn't that like blasphemous to say, to ask somebody if they're an alcoholic, if they're an Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "No. Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. If you're not an alcoholic, why would you come to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he's like, "Well, you know, I went out every Friday night drinking. I had just 10 to 12 drinks." I'm like, "So what happened after that?" "What do you mean?" I'm like, "What did you do after the 10 to 12 drinks?" He said, "Well, I was drunk." I said, "But what happened after that?" He said, "I go home." I'm like, "What happened when you got home?" "I go to bed." I'm like, "So you didn't like raid the liquor cabinet or try to see if you had any more beer in the fridge?" He's like, "No, I was tired." So then I went through the types in the back, and when I asked him about type 1, I went through all that description. He's like, "Well, I kind of have some of that." Type 2, no. Type 3, no. Type 4, no. I went back and asked him about the moderate. He's like, "Yeah, I kind of got some of that." I asked him about the hard drinker, and he's like, "Yeah, maybe." And then I went through the questions in the real alcoholic, and he's like, "No, no, 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 no." I'm like, "Well, buddy, you're not an alcoholic then." And he's like, "Well, why am I going to meetings then?" I said, "Well, I don't know." I was like, "Why hasn't your sponsor gone through this with you?" And he's like, "I don't know." I still talk to this guy on a regular basis. It's been 6 or 8 months. Guess what? Still no return to alcohol. And we identified this before I even asked him the question, because when you would ask him about like his life, and like, it was the craziest thing, is his wife kicks him out, steals his money, drains all the oil out of his Range Rover, such that when she finally gives it back to him, the engine blows up. And I'm like asking him about the resentments around this situation, and he says, "Well, you know, I probably shouldn't have left the Range Rover with her." I'm like, "Dude, you're not an alcoholic if you're not pissed off as hell about that." But so we've got to learn our truth, and that's why these pages are so important. So page 23. The top of page 23, this is where the book shifts from the mental to the physical, okay?
Vice versa.
What's that? Or other way around. From the physical to the mental. Thank you, Derek. Up to this point, we've been talking about what happens when I take the first drink or hit. And from the top of page 23 all the way to page 43, it's going to talk about what's going in here, what's going on up in my head. Because we've identified again and again and again that if I take a drink from a completely sober state, I'm absolutely insane. Top of page 23, it says, "These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink or hit, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic and addict centers in the mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on his last bender or spree, chances are he would offer you any 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have certain plausibility, but none of them really makes sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic drinking and drugging bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel his headache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of the alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth." Isn't it interesting that they don't say that once in a while he may lie? So our natural state is to lie. Once in a while, we might tell the truth. So, and the truth is, strange to say, He usually has no more idea why he took the first drink or hit than you have. Some drinkers and addicts have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time. But in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. Their obsession, there is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect they're down for the count. How many people in here, this is your first visit to a facility such as this? How many people have been to multiple? The multiples win over the first time people. So we've got a group of people in here that are armed with plenty of facts about themselves as alcoholics and addicts, and that really don't know why they went back out. No idea. And didn't just go back out. I suspect if you're here, you didn't just go out. You went out and you wrecked some shit, right? Because people that go back out for a little while usually find their way back in without a whole lot of effort. But the people that wreck some shit end up in places like this. Bottom paragraph. The tragic truth that if the man be a real alcoholic or addict, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. Whenever you see control in this book, it also means choice or power. What does the first step say? Powerless over alcohol. What does choice imply? Power. So if I have no power, I have no choice. And if I have no power, I have no control. Because if I did, I could stop when I wanted. At a certain point in the drinking career of every alcoholic or addict, he passes into the state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking or drugging is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics and addicts, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times. The problem is that there are times where sometimes we can use our willpower and our mind to stop. And we will use that one time out of 20 as the reason why I can go out and do it again tonight. Because there was this one time back in college when we did this. What is choice to stop look like for you today? I have this conversation with guys all the time. Have you ever had the power to stop? Yes. This one time back in college. Okay. Have you ever had the power to stop? Do you currently have the power to stop? Well, this one time back in college. They always want to refer to some time in the distant past when they were able to stop. Look at your most recent experience. Did you have any ability to stop? Because at certain times we can bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. But right now we are without defense against the first drink or drug. Probably pause there and come back and hit this.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. Let's come back in 15 minutes.